Bitcoin is heavily aligned with these sort of ideas, like I said, of federalism and subsidiarity and aligning the incentives and giving each level more capacity to exert itself against tyrannies that can form in the levels above them.
What Bitcoin Did is brought to you by our lead sponsor and massive legend, Iron, the largest NASDAQ-listed Bitcoin miner using 100% renewable energy. Iron are not just powering the Bitcoin network, they also provide cutting-edge computing resources for AI, all backed by renewable energy. So whether you're interested in mining Bitcoin or harnessing AI compute power, Iron is setting the standard. Visit iron.com to learn more, which is iren.com.
Good to see you both. It was my first time meeting Michael here in Austin.
Really? Yeah, that's
great. We've not met before, and
it's funny. I thought I had met him. And yeah. It was Kurt.
Yeah, you mixed me up with the camera guy, Kurt. I mean, we sound a little bit the same.
Yeah,
but thank you for both coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
You're back. I mean, you never really went anywhere, but you're back with the Nakamoto Institute, and you're back podcasting, which is very cool. Noded was one of my absolute favorite podcasts for a long time, so I'm glad you came back. Are you going to bring Noded back?
So I think that what we could do is take what we're recording for the Nakamoto Institute and throw that into the Noded feed.
Yeah, and we've been doing our annual episodes.
Yeah,
over time, each of us was getting older and had different career paths, mm-hmm. and just became harder and harder to schedule things well. And so for the longest time, Noded kind of drifted out. And with this, now that working on the Nakamoto Institute again, trying to revitalize it, when I wanted to do a new podcast, it was like, okay, I want to do it through the Nakamoto Institute for that. So that's where it ended up, and it has much more of a more purely educational bent than Noted, which was just kind of whatever felt right at the moment. Sometimes it was more technical, sometimes it was us just bantering, but it was broadly just our way of having parasocial relationships with just people who run nodes.
Well, I think there's room for both. I think you should bring Noded back more regularly.
We need more Bitcoin podcasts.
We do. Yeah. There's not enough.
Even if we have to make them all.
But why did you bring the Nakamoto, relaunch the Nakamoto Institute now? So I'll just give you a bit of context. When I was telling you this the other day, Michael, but when I first got into Bitcoin in sort of 2016, 2017, I went straight down the shitcoin rabbit hole. And when it got to the end of 2017, when everything was like going to shit, I remember thinking, I'm either going to give up on this thing and run away, or I'm going to try and figure out where the actual signal in the space is. And the Nakamoto Institute was where I found that. So first of all, thank you for that. But and when I kind of think back, do you know, have you watched Minority Report? Mm-hmm. The precogs that are like floating around in the milk or whatever. That's kind of how I think of you guys who started that. Because the stuff you saw that no one else saw way back in like 2013, 2014 is pretty incredible. So let's start there. Like, why do you think you had such like a clear sight of what Bitcoin was going to become?
I think that we're both into Austrian economics. That's how we met each other. So the Mises Circle was a Austrian economics reading group that Michael launched at UT Austin here just down the street. And so there's that. And then combined also with speaking for myself, when I was in high school, I was installing Linux on old computers and listening to Richard Stallman lectures. So I think the combination of sound money, the conclusion I'd come to was that we needed 100% reserve with gold, and that was like the best system, and that users should be able to control the software that they use, which I thought were two completely, unrelated mm-hmm. topics in my mind. And then when Bitcoin crossed those two topics, I immediately had this vision of this was going to get a tremendous amount of adoption.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I was a computer science student when I got into Bitcoin, and I've been a technical person my whole life, grew up on the internet, and the internet is full of P2P, you know, peer-to-peer file sharing and stuff like that, you know, has always been a big part of the internet as long as I was growing up. So it's more of just like a natural thing. You know, it's like, you know, Bane is, or not, yeah, you know, you were, you know, you merely adopted the internet. You know, I was born in it, molded by it. And so coming to find out about Austrian economics, everything that I think about Bitcoin, you know, descends from what I used to think about gold, only with a much more positive attitude, because the prospect of returning into a gold standard just was not as politically feasible as getting onto a Bitcoin standard has so far seemed politically successful in so many ways, and has actual broad adoption. I don't even mean just politics in the state sense, but just, you know, as the polity, the people in general, just actually adopting it. A little harder to get people to go buy up, you know, gold to put in their homes or whatever. So for me, yeah, having that Austrian background, as well as just like that, you know, just being born into the internet, nothing about Bitcoin in and of itself was really striking. The only thing that I had to get over was understanding the scarcity aspect of Bitcoin, because at first, you know, oh, it's like a fiat money because you're just making it up. And it wasn't until, so the first time that I learned about Bitcoin, you know, I watched it go up and I watched it go down. I even downloaded the software, opened it up. Nothing was happening. I didn't know about what are they called? Faucets. I didn't know about faucets at the time, so I couldn't even get my hands on any. Yeah. So it was just a completely pointless piece of software, and I uninstalled it. And only later, I learned about Bitcoin again, and I actually learned it within the context of, no, there's really a way to only have 21 million. And as soon as I could kind of think of it, you know, people don't like the digital gold meme because it feels limiting and they want to look into
I'm
the
in
new
that camp, I think.
Yeah. But at the same time, it was like, it was what helped me. It was like, oh, it's gold through the internet. Like, so take all of the things that you like about gold and more and put it on the internet and you have Bitcoin. It's like, I'm completely sold. And, yeah, like it almost too exuberant about the idea. It's like, oh, everyone's going to adopt this like really quick.
But you were kind of right. I mean, for anyone listening that doesn't know what the faucets were, that was like websites you go to that give you 50 Bitcoin just for free, which crazy to think about. But so you were into Austrian economics before Bitcoin. How did you sort of find Mises and Austrian economics? Because I assume you weren't taught that at school.
No, not at all. So this was summer year between my sophomore and junior year in high school. And I was going on Wikipedia. And on the front page of Wikipedia, they had a featured article that was anarcho-capitalism. And now with Wikipedia's politics, I don't think that they would allow that to be a featured article anymore. But back then, I guess anything went. And it was a high quality. It stood out as a high quality article. That's why they featured it. And to a young high schooler, it sounded really edgy. So I clicked on it and read it top to bottom. And at the end, thought to myself, well, yep, I'm an anarcho-capitalist now. and then it linked out to Mises.org, signed up for their newsletter, started downloading MP3s onto my iPod so I could listen to their podcasts. Early podcast enjoyer here.
Yes.
That was it.
I remember doing that, but I was listening to like Ricky Gervais or something.
Yeah.
But what was it that clicked? Like, what was it that was like, this is the thing for me?
I think that it was because my family had moved back and forth between the United States and France. And so I had a intuitive comparative analysis between different levels of statism. And I, you know, thought to myself, well, less is more. So, I think there was that. And then when I ran into the topic specifically within Austrian economics of the Austrian business cycle theory and of money and banking, and that's where it really clicked for me that here were some people with, you know, what you could describe as like secret esoteric knowledge, right? That they have an explanation for something that nobody else has an explanation for. And it's something that pervades society. People are constantly thinking and talking about it. So to me, it was like, oh, so this is yeah, this is something I'm not supposed to know about. I definitely want to know about it.
Do you think, so I've like nowhere near to the level you guys have, but I've read bits of Austrian economics. And one of the things that always stands out is that the explanations for things are much more simple. Do you think that actually puts people off because they're like, oh, it can't be that easy?
Perhaps, yeah.
I it depends on what Austrian economics you're reading. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, obviously something like Economics for in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt,
one of my favorite books,
everyone read. That's obviously going to naturally have a much more simple explanation for things, in the sense that he's trying to speak to a popular audience about these ideas. Although, you know, you can get into the literature and, you know, people tell me all the time, you know, the times that I've done work to try to explain some Misesian concepts in a Bitcoin context, they prefer that to reading Human Action because to them, Human Action is not so simple at all. It's actually, it's quite dense.
Okay.
So I think it can depend on what you're reading. It can get very dense because you have a lot of complex factors that you're having to deal with in a purely logical fashion. You can't just you know, run the statistical numbers on the history because in Austrian economics you have to theory sort of precedes history in the sense of you need a way to interpret what that data means in the first place. It doesn't tell the story itself. You have to know the logic of choice so that you can understand what those numbers might mean. But that being said, the way that it is written, even when it is more complex, it is way easier to read than if you go into kind of that level of, you know, Keynesian economics and such, because they do start to, you know, abstract into some crazy mathematics and stuff. It almost like loses sight of the human touch, I think is one of my big critiques of that. That's part of the problem with the mathematics and economics is, the logic can be shown in symbols, but there is this problem. It's like as you start to do that, you can forget that human element and start introducing mathematical logic that doesn't actually align with the realities of human action. But I think Rothbard had a quote of the more consistently an Austrian a writer is, the clearer his writing will be, because I think being grounded in human action sort of forces you to maintain that connection to the real world, even if some of the critics don't understand how that's the case. But I do get that sense as well. And, you know, over time, you know, I think that Mises, for instance, is extremely clear. It can be hard to read because it's just written at a sort of
Germanic.
That is a big kind of cultural thing, just like the style of writing is very different. But once you do kind of get a sense of it, I mean, it's to me it's like it's very clear, very straightforward, and it really helps bring alive some very rigorous logic in a really cool way. So
and when you first started getting into this, was there a moment where sort of the penny dropped and everything clicked?
Between senior, sophomore and junior year of high school, I'm a little younger than Pierre, so it was a little later. But the financial crisis had happened, and I, you know, tended to think of myself as an intelligent person, but the financial crisis humiliated me in the sense of making me realize that economics is something I know nothing about. I don't know what these words mean. You know, I'm hearing all this stuff on the radio and on the news and such, but I don't actually, it's all Greek to me. And so, you know, I had found a friend online who called himself an anarcho-capitalist and is like, well, he must know something about economics. It was someone else, I think, but he sent me classics like iPencil by Leonard Reed, and then which is I already had a libertarian bent from going back to like middle school and such, and I didn't think of myself as a libertarian, but I had a sense of, you know, that kind of almost iconoclasm of, like, you know, these sacred cows that you have about, you know, X, Y, and Z things. It's like, here's why it's all, you know, bogus, whether it's, you know, gun control or, you know, whatever topic du jour. I had that in me, and this started to, like, it coalesced into, like, oh, that's actually, like, a whole way of looking at the world. I think it was just a few paragraphs into iPencil, where, you know, he's describing, even something as simple as a pencil takes a whole marketplace, a whole division of labor to actually put together. And, it made me, it was like, okay, I kind of get what a market is. Mm-hmm. It's like this whole of human labor, you know, human, you know, division of labor and everything, working together. And yeah, you probably don't want to mess with that. And then, you know, the next thing I was reading, I was thrown into the deep end with Murray Rothbard. And so I just went whole hog into that. And, it worked out well for me. But that was kind of how I got into it. And, it all, you know, fit together, you know, very well. It just, like, the world made a lot more sense as I was thinking on that. And there was a lot more sort of, consistency in things. Mm-hmm. That greatly appealed to me. Kind of tying with the Bitcoin, like the internet stuff, one of the first topics that I had gotten into at the time, the Mises Institute was really starting to lean into, right at that time as I was getting into things, and anti-intellectual property, stance based on the great work of Stephen Kinsella, talking about how intellectual property as a concept is effectively a legal fiction and doesn't actually match the realities of what property is.
Why is that?
Basically, the long story short is that when you share an idea, you still have the idea, and so you can mm-hmm. use it. So it's reproducible. And so because it doesn't have that scarcity aspect, so in economics, scarcity is not merely, you know, the quantity of a thing, but the rivalrousness over that thing. So it's like, you know, there's a bunch of water bottles in here, but that one is yours and we can't both drink from it, mm-hmm. And get the, you know, the full bottle of water. Whereas with an idea, you can share an idea as many times as you want.
It's the double spend problem of an idea.
I would say that it's the opposite of a problem with an idea, but it is a huge problem when it comes to money. That to me, the reason I think that topic is very important is I think it helps better explain the nature of what property is in the first place, which is, you know, a relationship of between humans and each other and scarce resources, rather than just merely, you know, stuff. You know, this is my stuff and this is your stuff. It's mm-hmm. like there's sort of deeper, you know, human relationships built around scarcity. And where that comes into Bitcoin then is kind of what you're getting at, is why did I think that Bitcoin, like, at first is like, well, that doesn't make sense because, you know, you can just, it's just made up, is because anything online you can copy infinitely. Mm-hmm. But so when you do introduce something that actually has a scarcity aspect to it, that is extremely novel. It's completely novel. And obviously makes it, you know, much more interesting, and it, like, overcomes these things that had previously been fundamental issues. But now, because you have that, you can unleash the power of the internet on monetary technology.
This episode is brought to you by River, the best place for Bitcoiners and businesses to buy Bitcoin. With River, you can set up zero-fee recurring buys, making stacking sats effortless. And while you're waiting for the perfect buying opportunity, River lets you earn daily interest on your cash balance paid in Bitcoin, which outperforms most high-yield savings accounts. What really sets River apart is their unmatched dedication to security. You have peace of mind knowing that River has monthly proof of reserves and holds all Bitcoin in multi-sig cold storage. And with US-based phone support, you'll always have someone ready to help. To open an account, go to river.com/WBD and earn up to $100 in Bitcoin when you buy. That's RIVER.com/WBD. This episode is brought to you by AnchorWatch. The thing that keeps me up at night is the idea of a critical error with my Bitcoin cold storage. This is where AnchorWatch comes in. With AnchorWatch, you're protected by their time-locked multi-sig vault and with your own A-plus rated Lloyds of London-backed insurance policy. You get to hold your keys, AnchorWatch holds the risk. Whether you're worried about inheritance planning, wrench attacks, natural disasters, or your own mistakes, you're protected by AnchorWatch. Rates for fully insured custody start as low as 0.55% and are available for individual and commercial customers located in the US. Speak to AnchorWatch for a quote and for more details about your security options and coverage. Visit AnchorWatch.com today, which is AnchorWatch.com. I also want to give a quick shout out to the Human Rights Foundation's Financial Freedom Report. This is their weekly newsletter that drops every Thursday, and it covers how authoritarian regimes use money as a tool for control and how people are pushing back against that using privacy tools and, of course, Bitcoin. It's an amazing newsletter, it's pure signal, and you can subscribe for free at financialfreedomreport.org.
So I'm going to push you both to be a little less humble, because back in 2012, 13, 14, when you were writing these things, there were lots of Austrian economists that didn't see this future in the same way you guys did. Like, something obviously clicked for you. Like, Pierre, you were talking about the speculative attack in, was that 2013, 14?
Yeah, July 2014, yeah.
So try, just indulge me. Like, why did you see this? That's what I can't quite... Yeah.
So I had read a lot of monetary history. Also, you know, to give credit where credit is due, there were economists like Peter Serta, for example. He had written a whole paper from an Austrian economics perspective looking at Bitcoin and coming to, you know, the same conclusion of, hey, this is sound money.
Sorry to interrupt, but yeah. I mean, we basically like copied him in many ways. Like we had the Mises Circle economics reading group, and you know, our first Bitcoin meeting where we're like, hey, you know, we've been chattering about this Bitcoin thing, let's you know, do a proper reading on it. That was January or February 2013 or something like that. His master's thesis had already been out, you know, since sometime in the previous year, and that's what we read. Mm-hmm. Like, we read that, you know, so I still remember where I was sitting, you know, on UT campus reading that in preparation. I feel like I did more studying for the Mises Circle than I did for my actual classes, but I remember where I was sitting on campus, just like reading it and getting into it, and a lot of the ideas. He actually did a lot of great work of showing how this synthesizes with Austrian economics, and we sort of took that and ran with it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like we just completely you know, came out of nowhere with these ideas or anything. I think we just had the youthful exuberance and you know, arrogance? Kind of arrogance, radicalism, idealism, that all that sort, yeah, of stuff. That allowed us to, you know, have the freedom to take this idea seriously. Whereas there's sort of a generational thing where older people, you know, they might have trouble with the sort of technical aspects of it, and yeah, don't necessarily go into that to really appreciate it. You know, there's other stuff. But I, sorry to interrupt, but I did want to point out that you know, We were specifically reading that. It wasn't, mm-hmm, like just that he existed before us and that was also there. It's like we were reading from that.
Yeah.
Standing on the shoulders, mm-hmm, of giants. And so there was that. And then for speculative attack in particular, there was a paper written by, I think he's like an attorney somehow affiliated with the IMF. And it was about Bitcoin and speculative attacks. And when I read it, I thought, well, okay, he's onto something in the sense that this is how you have an acceleration of Bitcoin adoption. Because if you look at the history of monetary economics and, for example, George Soros and the Bank of England, there's a whole mm-hmm, story there about speculative attacks or in Asia. And so these are things that I had read about before. But when I read that IMF affiliated paper, I thought it was really interesting that when, you know, when we were learning about Bitcoin, I think a lot of people's intuition is, well, what we're going to have to do is go door to door to merchants and yeah, get them to accept Bitcoin payments. And mm-hmm, then we will have Bitcoin adoption. And that's how this is all going to happen.
I was one of those people, yeah, in, mm-hmm, in some sense. I mean, I you know, we can talk about this later. It's like, I believed in hoarding, you know, it's like everyone should be, you know, holding. I was broke anyway. So I could tell other people is like, you should totally buy some. Anytime I, you know, went out to you, say, hey, do you accept Bitcoin? And you know, of course no one even knew what I was talking about. But there was this feeling. It's like, yeah, you have to, you know, is peer to peer. You got to go talk to these. And Pierre was seeing that and seeing like a different vision of how this would go down.
Yeah. And so there's that aspect of getting adoption as a medium of exchange. And then there's the aspect of, okay, adoption is a store of value, but through the financial system, and in a judo move, essentially, of borrowing the weak currency to buy the strong currency. So borrowing dollars to buy Bitcoin. And that's how I call it the wider sphere of monetary economics, but it's actually a very specialized part of monetary economics would be analyzing currency competition and how that happens in the market. But what I didn't like about the IMF affiliated paper was that it didn't really describe the mechanism of a speculative attack in a good economically sound way. And so I thought to myself, well, you know, I should actually write a piece that explains it correctly so that I can predict how Bitcoin adoption is going to happen.
What do you think they missed in that piece?
It really was just the actual causal mechanism of like that. It was, I'd have to go back and look at it now, but at the time I thought that not only was it very convoluted and didn't hold together, but it also missed the critical aspects of what is a speculative attack from a fundamental economic perspective, and also would a government prevent it from happening? Mm-hmm. And so at the time I wrote that, you know, a government would prevent this from happening by raising interest rates. And we're now in that environment. And so we can talk about how that has slowed Bitcoin adoption as of late. Not stopped it, not reversed it, but certainly slowed it. And then I also pointed out capital controls. And so that is what we now call Operation Choke Point 2.0 of trying to stop the flow of money. If I could go back and amend it, although I don't need to now, I've actually written a follow-up with Alan Farrington, that another way to defend against it, but also essentially to surrender, is to have a strategic Bitcoin reserve. So that is the kind of the third pathway that we're now exploring as a society.
Yeah, that's what I was going to bring up. When you say interest rates have slowed Bitcoin adoption down, but we've obviously it's not slowed Michael Saylor down to any large degree, and we've now got a strategic Bitcoin reserve. So what do you mean by that?
So what I mean is that if you can borrow at 0% and invest at, you know, let's say that 40% CAGR of Bitcoin that people cite, that's a wider spread than if you're borrowing at 5%. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, borrowing from Saylor, you know, he points out that people adopt Bitcoin kind of when they're desperate, they don't have anything else. And so if they have an appealing nominal yield on, you know, their savings account, they're less desperate than they otherwise would be. And to me, it's like, okay, well, this is a very temporary state of affairs, because inevitably what's going to happen is that the credit system is going to start having seizures, and that they're going to do, you know, quantitative easing again, and we'll go back to 0% interest rates inevitably. But also that it doesn't stop Bitcoin adoption in the sense that there's still a positive spread between the expected return of holding Bitcoin and the cost of financing that trade in dollar terms. Not to mention, obviously, the fundamentals that we talk about of seizure resistance, censorship resistance, that are also providing a baseline amount of adoption for Bitcoin.
When you wrote that piece, how far out were you thinking? Like, when did you think the speculative attack might happen?
Next year, you know, my girlfriend at the time, now wife, Morgan, I told her, you know, the financial system as we know it today, fiat, that's all very, you know, it won't be here next year. And that in the piece, I pointed out that kind of the prerequisite for this would be an amount of liquidity. And I didn't really specify like how much liquidity would be needed. I guess, you know, in hindsight, what I really missed in pointing out that there's a tremendous amount of liquidity needed to do this, is because the pesky early adopters, they step on it. So whenever Bitcoin is doing very well against the dollar, they decide that they need to sell and buy a Lambo or, you know, put their kids through college or pay off their parents' mortgage.
Selfish.
Yeah, donate to their favorite charity, contribute to the Nakamoto Institute. And so there's all of this rebalancing sell pressure from the wealth effect that absorbs this new demand. Mm-hmm. Whereas if everybody had diamond hands, we could have destroyed the dollar many years ago now.
This is such an important point because people usually, I mean, the term hoarding itself is in the economic lexicon as a pejorative towards people mm-hmm. who are holding a cash balance, because the sort of standard mainstream economic view is that if you are holding that money, it's not being put to productive use.
Yeah.
Whereas we would argue, frankly, you know it's productive to someone because otherwise they wouldn't be doing it in the first place. Mm-hmm. So our job is to figure out why is it productive? And why is it productive? It's because it is reducing uncertainty about the world because you're holding on to the most liquid good or a very liquid good so that you know this is something that you can take on future opportunities with more ease, whether it's good or bad. And so it's a sort of hedge against future uncertainty. And Bitcoin is the best at that because it is the least uncertain asset. You know how much you have, it's durable, transportable, all the good stuff. But because they don't like holding cash balances, they want the economy to be stimulated. They want the circular flow of cash payments and stuff. They use words like hoarding to attack it. Mm-hmm. And this is funny because when you have these OGs, you'll see the whale account say it's like these coins haven't moved since 2010. Like what a legend and whatever. It's like, well, unless he's moving it into a better cold storage, which if it was set up in 2010, they should probably be doing so, yeah. But like, unless they're doing that, you could say, this is like somehow good or something, but mm-hmm. actually, I see it is sort of selfish. It's like we could be, having Bitcoin accelerate, to full global adoption and end, all of the monetary destructive forces in this world that does everything from just destroy capital in general to fueling socialist regimes and so on and so forth. We could be putting an end to all of that, but instead you're deciding you'd prefer a Lambo.
Yeah,
and so there's sort of everyone has their individual preferences and rights and all of that, but there is a sort of selfishness to it if you think about it from some angles.
I guess on the flip side of that, though, the more distributed Bitcoin gets, the better for Bitcoin as well.
But you could have a 5% of the total Bitcoin supply be like distributed among millions of people, and that 95% of it is just held by like one early whale or something. Mm-hmm. And so that would actually cause the value of it to, but it's all very like theoretical. But to me, it was, working when I, at my previous role at Kraken, it was kind of funny to me when I'd hear people say that nobody spends their Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And then I'd see like people selling a lot of Bitcoin to acquire dollars, but not to hold the dollars to go acquire something else. And so it was just.
But even then, I mean, even if they're just selling for dollars, you're selling your Bitcoin.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. You're spending it.
You no longer have a use for Bitcoin.
Yeah. Yeah. And that the dollars are just a utility token for payments. And so it's not like because you're not spending it directly for goods and services that it's not being spent. It mm-hmm. really, truly is.
Yeah. I don't know if it was in the speculative attack piece or one of the other essays you did, but I remember there's a chart where you were saying that we were moving at that point from like the innovator stage to the early adopter phase.
Yeah.
That seemed like you might have been getting ahead of yourself there. Where do you think we are on that now?
Well, yeah. we talked about this on the podcast, yeah. and Yeah, I mean, you can...
Well, yeah, we'll tell people, you're the one go listen to our podcast. Don't listen to this podcast, listen to our podcast.
No, that one's much higher signal.
No. I think I was completely delusional and wrong. And so we are so early, and you know, that's not a meme. So I still think that... So there's kind of different ways of looking at that percentage. If you look at it of just... brand recognition, mm-hmm. we're already at 95% brand recognition.
Everyone knows what Bitcoin is now.
Yeah. Or they've heard the word. Yeah. I don't know that they know what it is.
Yeah, it's a good distinction. In 2013, if you were going, oh, do you accept Bitcoin? The question was literally, it was like,
what is Bitcoin?
What is that?
Yeah.
Whereas now you still might have someone saying is like, what is that really?
Mm-hmm.
But underneath it, it's like they're asking that because it's like they want to know about this thing that they know
about.
And
they might be like, is this crypto? Like they won't get the distinction, but they've heard the word.
They know that there's a digital something out there and they know that Bitcoin exists. And that's, you know, that's obviously huge. That's the first step in the marketing funnel to getting them to, you know, stack some sats and play a part in this new economy. But
I had a friend recently say, hey, I heard crypto is at $87,000. It's like, okay, that's how we're using the word. Huh? Now crypto's just Bitcoin. Okay.
Maybe we need to take it back.
That would also be acceptable.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
And so if we're at 95% sort of brand recognition, as it were, where do you think we are on the rest of everything?
Well, so then you have adoption in the sense of somebody holds an ETF or they hold an index fund that holds MicroStrategy, mm-hmm. right? And so maybe let's say that's at 15 or 20%. But then if we go deeper into what percentage of that person's balance sheet is in Bitcoin, and if we look at everybody's balance sheets, right, what percentage of total global wealth is in Bitcoin, I still think we're at less than 1%.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you look at what percentage of people are running their own node and doing a multi-sig with their, their hardware wallet and cold storage, you know, again, less than 0.01%. So I think that this is very bullish because that mm-hmm. means that Bitcoin's price can go up tremendous amount from here and will. It's also very humbling of we've got a lot of educational work to do.
Totally. That's why we're doing this, right?
Yeah.
And so that's one thing you got wrong. What are the other big things that stand out as something you were like, we were way off base on that?
Yeah. So timing, percentage, I also think that we were pretty much wrong, or at least I was overly optimistic on how dismissive people would be of altcoins.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, yeah.
we haven't gotten to, so for people who haven't listened to our podcast, check it out. But we're going through our old mempool posts, our blog, that, you know, all the articles that kind of made up this Bitcoin worldview that we developed from about 2013 to 2015. It's all in those articles, and we're going article by article, reading through them and looking back at them with the historical context to, you know, maybe there's some things where it's like, you need a little historical context. What was going on at the time to really understand what we were saying, because times have changed.
Yeah.
Memes have changed. There's other stuff where it's like, you know, we use this like chart of like, oh yeah, we're entering the early adopters, innovators phase, or like all that stuff. And then we're like, this is a really stale meme, and it was not really good to begin with. So we look at the stuff that we think was wrong. We haven't even got into the altcoin stuff. And that's something that in many ways we were more right than we could imagine. Mm-hmm. In other ways we were not as we were dismissive, but we also assumed that there would be a more general dismissiveness. And, you know, we can get into the reasons why that might be.
And was that because you just faded the idea that everyone loves to gamble and like people are going to go out and speculate on this stuff?
I think it was more of just an expectation. It's like, we saw that it was stupid. And it's like, when we mm-hmm. look, you know, all the way down to the end, we see the end of the tunnel. And at the end of all this monetary competition, Bitcoin is the thing that eats everything up.
Mm-hmm.
And the universe prefers a single currency over multiple currencies. Because, you know, it's just like
everything converges on one eventually.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, any reversion from that is at some level a reversion to barter.
Mm-hmm.
So the universe tends towards a single currency. Bitcoin's the best currency. So at the end, we see Bitcoin is like that. that ignores, like, that doesn't mean that in the whole process people are not finding ways to try to, you know, game their way down that whole tunnel, or, you know, it doesn't even mean that everyone believes that that's going to be the end game. So you have all kinds of you know, more we were focused on the long term, mm-hmm. and most people, especially the people who are interested in altcoins, are focused on the short and medium term, and so they still percolate, and that's just something you have to deal with.
Do you think part of the reason for that is that, like, the shitcoins at the time were basically trying to be Bitcoin but better, whereas, like, the shitcoins that came later had a whole other bunch of narratives behind them?
Well, so the first one I heard about was Litecoin, mm-hmm. and you know, essentially somebody was like, "Hey, you're like an old boomer if you're still focused on Bitcoin. Like, yeah. Litecoin's the future." And then I, you know, I tried to understand, like, their perspective, because at that time I was not a toxic maximalist yet. I was like, "Okay, all right, why is this, you know, why is this better?" Well, first they were like, "Well, it's the silver to Bitcoin's gold," and I'm like, "Well, Bitcoin's divisible, so you don't really need a silver, you know, to 100 million Satoshis." And then second was that it had a faster block time. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, okay, well, that's interesting. I go look and I see that, you know, the transaction finality, the equivalency is over the same amount of time. And so even if you have a faster block time, it doesn't actually give you more transaction finality, or like, it doesn't help in any meaningful sense. So then, you know, when I presented these counter arguments to this person, they didn't really, you know, like, it's not like I persuaded them of anything. And it didn't click for me that what was interesting about altcoins was that because they were less liquid than Bitcoin, that they could actually outperform over certain timeframes, mm-hmm. and that would be very appealing to a lot of people, that, you know, they felt like they had missed Bitcoin. Perhaps because, like, at the time it was, like, so early in Bitcoin, although I kind of felt like I'd missed Bitcoin, you know, 2013.
Yeah, I felt very late.
But in any sense, it was like that's not something that I understood myself. And so I didn't realize how many people would, you know, find that to be an interesting aspect of altcoins.
Mm. That kind of gets back into the unit bias, which I think is still potentially an issue today.
Yeah.
So if that's one thing that you got wrong, what's the thing that stands out that you're like, we were so right?
I think that the Bitcoin itself had the right set of incentives to be able to survive.
Yeah.
And so that was, I think, an open question at the time of how is this going to last for a decade? Mm-hmm. And we were right about it being able to last for a decade.
I think this comes from sort of the Austrian stuff. There's always been an Austrian streak in the Bitcoin community. But I think we were among some of the first, obviously, like we said, like Peter Serda came before us. But I think we were sort of among the first cohort that was looking at it through a very, like, kind of hardline firm Austrian lens, mm-hmm. As opposed to, you know, broadly speaking, people get into Bitcoin for all kinds of reasons. So you have, like, I'm in it for the tech, you know, stuff like that. And because we came at it from that perspective, we were also able to bring ideas like, you know, hoarding Bitcoins is actually a good thing. And the way that a monetary network is going to grow is through hoarding, not spending per se. And so, you know, that was contrary to basically, you know, most people. That's why we were writing, you know, articles about that, was to sort of combat these things. But, you know, we were, to also be clear, it's not like we were, like, super popular guys back then. I know, like, we have a bit of a following now, but back then, you know, we were just some punk college kids
shouting the internet.
Yeah. And, you know, we were just kind of aiming at, you know, our libertarian friends and stuff like that. But because we had that and we could see things like, you know, savings being such a vital part of the growth of a monetary network, I think that has been a much more robust model for understanding Bitcoin. And that's why over time that became a dominant thing. We were sort of early. We just like latched onto the right thing that could withstand a lot of the different things. You've had all of these narrative battles in Bitcoin, and I think it's because any narrative is a sort of lower resolution explanation of the sort of capital T truth of the universe. Mm-hmm. And ours just it had some of the right stuff that made it much more robust. Whereas if your vision of Bitcoin was purely, it's like, oh, we got it, it's peer-to-peer cash, we have to spend, without some savings component really being like a core thing, it could get very easy to find yourself down paths of, you know, wanting big blocks and, you know, being more open to that, and so on and so forth. So there's all kinds of narratives that fell apart, and I think that Austrian Foundation gave a strong thing, and savings, Bitcoins as savings technology, I think was one of the sort of key memes around that allowed it to be so far much more robust.
And now Michael Saylor saying that on Fox.
Yeah.
Isn't it funny that, like, without a typo and a drunk blog post, hoarding Bitcoin would probably be like the lexicon.
Yeah. Sort of hodl.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess like when we, I think the article that we have that especially focuses on that, I believe may have come out prior to that post.
Yeah.
But it certainly had not become a meme yet.
Yeah.
It wasn't until, like, I think the process of that becoming the meme was you had more instances of Bitcoin going up and then going down. And every time it was going down, it was like, you know, HODL. People mm-hmm. have, you know, the 300, you know, Spartans, you know, HODL, you know, and that sort of just kind of baked itself into the lexicon.
Even outside of like the Bitcoin narratives, I think that something that we were very right about was for 12 years, we had people telling us, hey, look, it's blockchain technology. Okay. Bitcoin, yes. The currency aspect of it is a distraction. Like, this technology is applicable to supply chains and medical records, and that's what's going to transform the world. And you crazy libertarians and, you know, your digital gold is just irrelevant to this wider revolution in blockchain technology. And, you know, we had to get called idiots for 12 years while Bitcoin was going up in value.
But now you get to call them idiots forever.
Well, I don't want to call them idiots. I mean, I want them to, like, actually listen to
join
us.
The team.
Yeah. You know, to buy some Bitcoin and enjoy, the NGU. But it's something where I think that for me, you know, beyond, like, being a libertarian, it was like, okay, yeah, that's, we're not winning, so I understand you being skeptical of libertarian politics. But with Bitcoin, it was like, we're winning. So I don't know where this skepticism is coming from beyond just some kind of ego trip.
Yeah.
Now that you say that, I think that's an incredibly important point about, you know, what was something that stood out for us, I think, was not only was like savings important, but you have to go one step deeper, which is like, well, what are you saving? It's like money. And a lot of people, very few people were, you know, sort of just hit the center of that nerdy Venn diagram to think money is actually super important, if not one of the most important things, mm-hmm. you know? So going back, we had the Mises Circle. Why did I create the Mises Circle? There were two reasons. One was that, you know, I'm a nerd. And so when you have a sort of broader libertarian group, there's always new people coming in and you need to get those people up to speed. So it's like, oh, let's talk about the broken window fallacy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just an important economic concept. Like, let's talk about that. And then you move on or whatever. And then, you know, the next meeting, there's like a new person who's like, oh, hey, you're new. So anyway, there's the thing, broken window fallacy. And it just like continues on and on. It's like, you know, being in Groundhog Day, it's just like every meeting you come to, it's like, oh, let's like talk about the broken window fallacy again. And I really wanted to get into the deep cuts. I liked reading, you know, 900 page books, mm-hmm. you know, by Austrian economists about, you know, in fact, like ones that were specifically about money. I was like fine with reading those, and I wanted to talk to my friends about those. And so the Mises Circle was the place to be able to do that. The other side of it was that You know, if you can be, you know, libertarians, it's a very broad group. The term can sometimes be so broad that it's practically meaningless.
Yeah.
In terms of like, what do people even mean by liberty is, you know, a huge question that people have been pondering for, you know, thousands of years. And you get kind of like a hodgepodge of people, you know, coalescing around different labels. So you end up with a whole bunch of libertarians. And we found ourselves in our libertarian group, a lot of us just wanted to talk about the Fed. You know, it's like how bad the Fed is. I mean, end the Fed. This is awful. And others would want, you know, it's like, hey, you know, maybe we can talk about this or that, you know, other idea, you know, some maybe like a, you know, civil rights issue or, you know, whatever. And we were just, no, we got to talk about the Fed because it's like, why do you think that's a problem? It's because the Fed has been printing money. So, you know, which also, you know, the Bitcoin fixes this kind of memeology that descends from the views that we've had for a long time that money printing is at the core of so much social woes. So there was also this, even within these groups that we were in, to be saying, even people who also dislike the Fed, to be so zeroed in on money being so important to both the actual productive capacity of a society, but also on the converse, when you mess with it, just how destructive it can be to society and how of all the things in the world, you know, of what are the most important things to try to reform, we're looking at effectively central banking, war, et cetera, et cetera. And so, and even, you know, war, there's a question of how much of it is fueled by central banking in particular, or at least like the nature of modern war coming from that. So even within our circles, to be as focused on explaining to people the importance of money and the importance of getting it right was very unique. And so
and looked down upon.
Yes. Yeah. It was like, you know, we're kind of like, okay, I guess I'm just gonna go start, you know, like a side group, and we'll, you know, just go on over there to talk in our corner about these things that matter. Because, you know, everything else always, you know, feels more important. And, you know, money is sort of this meta thing, right? Mm-hmm. Where it's like, you know, even when we say Bitcoin fixes this, we don't like literally mean that, like, oh, blockchain technology from Bitcoin is going to cure cancer or something. It's more about
how it changes incentives.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's a recognition that the monetary incentives are so great that if you put them on a better track, we have expectations of the rot of institutions to start to go away and for more healthy institutions to develop that actually attack these problems with a more, you know, rational, so to speak, way of going about it. So, I think you're right that us recognizing money, and if you notice throughout the history of Bitcoin, so getting into the Bitcoin world, you get all sorts of people who it's like, you know, even in Bitcoin, oh, it's not just about money, you know, it's mm-hmm. about these other things. And for the ones who are Bitcoiners, it's like, oh, it's much more than that. It's like, usually it's like what they're describing is, yeah, that's what money gives us. Money allows us to have the coordination and such that gives us the nice kind of lofty ideals that you're describing. But then you have the people who are anti-Bitcoin in a sense, like, you know, altcoiners, where I'm saying they're anti-Bitcoin in the sense that, hey, my thing is better than Bitcoin. You should be focused on my thing as being more important than Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Not even just, you know, side by side. It's like, this is more important. It's like, oh, we made Prime Coin, and Prime Coin generates prime numbers, and that's good for this like niche, you know, mathematical, interest that people have. And somehow that's like that utility is more important than just money itself. Or we see it in DeFi in general, where people are like, oh, they get all these financial games. Like, look at us. We get to think about all these new ways to play shell games with one another without thinking about all of finance begins at savings. Mm-hmm. Savings is the original finance, where you put things away for the future to be able to finance some kind of capital production. And we're the ones who are like, no. It's like, if you want all of that, you have to fix the money first. You have to be focused on the money so that when you're building financial tools, it's actually based around real capital production. Long rant, but I think that's a very important point. And I'll step out of the humility there. I think that we were very right to view money as basically a fundamental pillar of civilization, and it should be taken that seriously. Mm-hmm. And Bitcoin was giving us the way to take it that seriously with actual winning in mind.
It's funny that you mentioned like not wanting to constantly talk about the broken window fallacy, because I have the same problem with the podcast where like I want it to be super accessible. I don't want it to be a ton of assumed knowledge to come in here and like listen to a show. But at the same time, you can't start every show with what is Bitcoin? Like, so it's a really hard line to tread. But you brought up Big Block before. When you were writing these pieces, it was probably like at the very start of that kind of debate happening, I guess, around like 2015. Is that about right?
Yeah. I mean, by the time a lot of these articles were written, the real debate had not heated up. It was, mm-hmm. it was something that was in the background. You had people talk about as like, you know, in the long run, you know, hey, maybe we're going to need to increase the block size. Or you had some people who had already taken positions of, no, actually, you know, you want the blocks to stay the same for, whatever reasons. But it wasn't until I think after these articles had primarily been written that the debates really got heated.
Yeah. So you didn't really get into that very much on.
Not at the time. And, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we could have gotten into, but, at the time, I think, you know, we had stronger opinions, but there was also, a sense of not really knowing, the full end game. There was like a, you know, it is possible that we're wrong. The position that I had taken as editor at the time was, if we could, do like a really strong balanced kind of thing of like really getting into it. And we just didn't have the things were a little more dormant by that time. So it didn't become like this, debate center for it. And so the editorial policy that I had was more just like, well, let's just make it ecumenical for now and focus, you know, on other things.
Yeah. And, you know, I was strongly in the small block camp from the beginning, because when I heard the argument of, oh, well, we need to have more payments so that Bitcoin's value increases, I was like, well, that's wrong. So let's just right off the bat. And then the counter argument of, well, we need nodes to be affordable so that Bitcoin's decentralized. So I was like, yeah, well, that's right. And so, obviously, at the time, Daniel Krawitz was contributing articles, and he had the complete diametric opposite perspective.
Yeah.
And so it was like, okay, well, let's keep the Nakamoto Institute be like Switzerland, you know, neutral, because obviously we've got two very conflicting views from people contributing to it. And I had a debate on IRC with Gavin Andreessen. And this is back in 2014, I think, or maybe 2015. Yeah,
maybe early 2015, but early definitely 2015. Back then.
And so already at that point, this is, you know, before any kind of forks or anything like that, I just didn't buy the argument at all that this was an existential question for Bitcoin, that we needed to increase the block size limit. And I still feel that way about a lot of conversations I have with people in Bitcoin, where they're like, oh, if this doesn't happen, then Bitcoin fails. Or if this happens, then Bitcoin fails. And I kind of run it through that like verification process of, is that actually true? Does Bitcoin actually fail, you know, in these circumstances? And it's usually just like fear mongering of somebody like trying to advance their cause by being little exaggerating.
I think also, I was kind of somewhat more in the middle at the beginning. I wasn't as quick to Pierre to that side, but I remember kind of I was not impressed with the argument that the conservative way to look at things was to keep the keep the economics the same. That's how they would say it, is like keep the economics the same. It's like, oh, we're used to not paying fees, so therefore we shouldn't have to pay fees. Mm-hmm. Whereas there was this, changing the block size. Like, so we never really went up against the limit back then. Not much, at least. Like, it just, so it was there. So it was like the conservative thing is just to keep kicking it down.
Yeah.
But it was around these times that we were also only starting to really think about things like soft forks versus hard forks, which just forces you to think more about backwards compatibility and the importance of that. And, anyway, it took me some more time, but you know, I actually remember that being rather persuasive to me, because you can always change Bitcoin theoretically, like in some mm-hmm. sense. Like, everyone can wake up tomorrow and decide we want to change, and if everyone goes along, you can even make sure that everyone goes along with it. Like, that can happen, but that doesn't mean you have to change now. The market gives signals and lets you know that you actually need to change. And you might also come up with creative solutions, before that, so that you don't actually have to change the technicals. And I think that's one of the things that I got from what Pierre was saying, which was like, one of the arguments he was making was that transaction fees are much more inelastic than people want to think. Mm-hmm. So people think that if transaction fees go up, then we just don't see any more transactions. But as that played out later on, as transaction fees really did grow, stinks to if you just wanted to move $5 worth of Bitcoin and you have to pay a $50 fee in that moment, that can stink. But the rest of the network doesn't care, and it's mm-hmm. still is actually chugging along. But that also ended up inspiring. To be clear, some of what I'm saying is stuff that I came to the conclusion later, not literally. This also inspired people to come up with better solutions of how to deal with the constraints as they were, and SegWit, which allowed a lot better throughput, and also obviously the basis of things like the Lightning Network, all of these allowed people, other ways of dealing with this block space than just increasing the thing. And when you start to understand backwards compatibility, it's like, actually, that matters to me a lot. Mm-hmm. In fact, in some ways, I think backwards compatibility might be more important than the sort of raw cost of a node.
I agree.
But these were all things like this took a long time to really Pierre saw that with that, but I'm sure he can say how his ideas developed on that over time. It was like that whole period. There was a lot of learning, and I certainly came down on the small block the small block size, but at the time, yeah, it was I was fine not getting into it at the time. Maybe now, I mean, we see that there's still a lot of the arguments or dispositions that people have towards these ideas that might demand a more rigorous look at some of these topics, and maybe that's something that still needs to happen. It's not just in the past. At the time, it never led to us doing that. And yeah, like, especially with our desire to be more of a Swiss, kind of thing until there at the end. And then at that point, I don't know, we're just more sucked into fighting on Twitter than writing think pieces.
Yeah, it's great. Like, when you look back, so Daniel Kravitz wrote some amazing pieces. It's wild to me that that's something he missed. It doesn't seem like it fits with the earlier pieces that he was writing.
Well, I will at least say that some of his arguments around big blocks, he was unique among, at least what it seemed like from not being on that team, unique among them in that he was not talking about the need for actually spending Bitcoin, and his arguments, for better or worse, were about a concern about whether or not, when people want to spend, if the if the network would be able to handle that kind of liquidity. So there were certain aspects of it that were uniquely his, and actually sort of in that narrow band shared with, you know, the small block size. But so, you know, Daniel was always a very unique thinker. So I'm also not surprised by that fact.
This episode is brought to you by Casa, the leading Bitcoin self-custody solution. I've been using Casa since 2019, and I can't recommend them enough. Casa have options for all Bitcoiners, from a 2-of-3 multisig to a 3-of-5 and a private client option for absolute best-in-class security. Casa also do inheritance, which I very recently set up, and it really couldn't be easier. My inheritance plan has gone from a vague treasure map for my wife to a rock-solid security plan that I have total confidence in. To find out more about Casa, go to casa.io, which is casa.io. This episode is also brought to you by Ledger. If you're serious about protecting your Bitcoin, Ledger has the solution you need. Their hardware wallets give you complete control over your private keys, ensuring that your Bitcoin stays safe from hacks, phishing, and malware. With Ledger's easy-to-use devices and the Ledger Live app, managing your Bitcoin has never been more convenient. Whether you're a long-time holder or new to the world of Bitcoin, Ledger makes it simple to keep your assets protected. If you want to find out more, visit ledger.com and secure your Bitcoin today. That's ledger.com. I also want to tell you about Cheat Code. On April the 11th to the 13th, we're going to be back in Bedford, and we have an amazing lineup of speakers, including XPM Liz Truss, Preston Pish, Alex Gladstein, Nat Brunel, James Lavish, and so many more. We then have a football day where we'll hopefully see Rail Bedford win the league again. Last year was amazing. This year is going to be better, but tickets will sell out for this. So if you want to come, head over to cheatcode.co.uk and grab a ticket.
So let's bring it to today. Obviously, both of you came at this from a very libertarian perspective. We've now got the US potentially stacking Bitcoin, at least saving the Bitcoin they've got. Pierre, I asked Michael this the other day, so I'll go to you first. Have you been surprised to see Bitcoiners kind of cheering on the state so much, when this was always about separating money and state?
So I'm not surprised at all. And I'm among them cheering on the state on this. Because ultimately, and I mean, it was just astonishing to hear Larry Fink saying this on national television. Bitcoin exists above governments. Mm-hmm. And so when a government, when a state adopts Bitcoin, it is the ultimate act of separating money from the state. They are bending the knee and kissing the ring. And it's a tremendous act of humility to say, okay, we're adopting this because it is greater than we are. And so I see it as the, you know, a process of almost abdication of monetary sovereignty and kind of transfer of power, peaceful transfer of power, which should be applauded, because I think that it's completely rational move for the state to make. You know, ultimately, if the state does not adopt Bitcoin, it's not like Bitcoin goes away. You know, they can't wish it away as much as Elizabeth Warren would like to. And so I think that it represents the ideological defeat of chartalism, which is long overdue. It's the beginning of a process of really formally separating money and the state, and kind of transitioning the dollar away from being fiat to being something different, which I don't know exactly what it's going to end up looking like. I think ideally we get to a situation where the strategic Bitcoin reserve has enough Bitcoin in it where it is fully backing the dollar, where one Satoshi is backed by, or $1 is backed by one Satoshi in the reserve. And it's a 1-for-1 thing. And they, we have the political will to keep that to be the case, so that the dollar is what I call layer 21 scaling technology, and that we have the fortitude to make it work. Whereas, when we tried that with the gold standard, it didn't work because we didn't do it 100% reserve. Mm-hmm. We did a fractional reserve. And I think that was a huge mistake, and we have to re-architect the financial system to be 100% reserve, so we don't go back down that same road.
I definitely want to ask you about fractional reserve, but do you think the government are thinking about it the same way you are? Do you think they realize what they're doing?
So that's a great question. I think that there's different perspectives within the government on what this is all about. I think that ultimately it's about if we want this future, we have to engage in the political process. Which does mean meeting people where they're at, and we've got many decades ahead of us. Bitcoin's not going to happen next year, unlike what I previously thought. So every year that goes by, it's like, okay, that adds another decade to, you know, what I think how long it's going to take. But I also take it now far more seriously of the question of, what happens to everyone else, right? So if I was correct in 2013 that the dollar collapsed in 2014 and that everybody, you know, who was relying on the dollar was just out of luck and that their financial life fell apart overnight, I think that would be hugely destructive to society. I think that that would, you know, destroy so much of what people had worked for decades, you know, building up their nest egg or whatever it is, that we have to find a very graceful way to have hyper Bitcoinization so that we're not tearing apart the fabric of society and destroying people's lives. And so I think that that's probably now that I have three kids myself, a more serious approach to this. And I think that if people in government are wise, that they have the same desire to have a very graceful transition.
Yeah, I remember Andreas coming on the old version of What Bitcoin Did saying it's no good if like society collapses around you, you run outside your house like, yay, I'm rich because you have Bitcoin, and then everyone else is in ruins. Like, that's not a good outcome for this.
You also wouldn't be rich because the purchasing power of your Bitcoin would not be what you would want it to be.
It would also be much easier to scapegoat Bitcoiners and blame them for that which has happened. Because look, like of us, even though we're all poor, you're less poor because you have the thing that, you know, retained more value. And so it's much easier to scapegoat, which is not good, because in that case, you're scapegoating the entirely wrong institution. Bitcoin was the thing that actually gave more opportunity and gave it to everyone, and is the thing that as people come into it, it allows more. It is an upgrade. So one of the things with like hyper Bitcoinization is the idea that with hyperinflation, you have the destruction of society effectively, but with hyper Bitcoinization, everyone who's at the margins adopting a better money is now able to live a better economic life. And so it's all good. And if those people, if people are viewing, and we've seen them at times, you know, try to start pointing fingers at Bitcoiners for this and that, you know, Elizabeth Warren's one who loves to do this, and that can distract, you know, people who, you know, we want what's best for them. We want a better economic life for those people. That's why we advocate for Bitcoin. So if they get scammed into believing that it was Bitcoiners that caused it instead of the people that we felt the need, like we needed Bitcoin because the central bankers were there, that's pointing fingers at the wrong people. And that's also not helping those people get back on those feet. So it's like a double whammy for them where, their monetary life has collapsed and they have a fundamentally wrong idea about why that happened. That's going to keep them from being able to reestablish themselves. So, I do agree, as you know, that there is a sort of prudence to wanting a more peaceful transition into a better monetary upgrade. The thing is it is sort of up to the government and the central bankers to have that prudence, but also because Bitcoin is where it's at, they're actually willing to listen to us now. I've been surprised by some of the people that I've had the chance to talk with. I'm not out there, you know, talking to tons of people, but it's like some of the people I have found myself talking to, it's like, it's interesting to have that opportunity. And the fact that they are actually willing to listen to me, especially considering not that long ago, we were total idiots. We were total cranks. That makes me excited that, you know, maybe they will, different people, you know, the government is not a big monolith. There are many people with many interests, that a lot of them will start to actually become Bitcoiners in a real way. Some politicians around the world have already shown that. I think Bukele, obviously, you know, different people are going to have, criticisms of this or that, and there's concerns about IMF and so on and so forth. But it would be hard for me to look at him and think of him as anything but having become a big Bitcoiner, you know, like a real Bitcoiner in whatever choices that he's having to make. I don't know enough about the trade-offs that he is facing as a head of state. But I know that, and it's just wild to think, I know that when he's making those decisions, he's doing it with a sort of Bitcoin maxi attitude as part of the calculation for those trade-offs. Yeah. And I think more governments would probably be making better decisions on behalf of people if Bitcoin maximalism was a part of their trade-off calculation. And finally, the thing I'll say is that, it's not like not everyone gets into Bitcoin because they have grand idealism for the good of society. And this is, I just want to, you know, altruistically contribute to the common good and stuff like that. Mostly, I think for a lot of us, you know, it's just number go up. And so you just see number go up and you do that. And that is that's a gateway drug because, well, if number goes up and I want to hitch myself to this wagon, well, you do have to start understanding why is that wagon experiencing number go up in the first place? Yeah. And that forces you to actually look into what it is about this. And in the end, even if they didn't come into it for sort of altruistic reasons, at some point you do start to develop a sense of the real social benefits of Bitcoin. And I'm as skeptical of the government as anyone else, but I'm not so skeptical of all individuals, literally all individuals. And I do think that we could see a real shift, and that could have a beneficial impact on, you know, how those people view Bitcoin and you know, how Bitcoin relates to society as a whole too.
Yeah, the Bukele one's interesting. I find it a hard one to kind of balance because on one side, like clearly he's a Bitcoiner, like he gets this. And I know he's made the country much safer, but I can't agree with imprisoning people who haven't been committed of a crime. So like I find that a really tricky one to balance because obviously the trade-off is the country is much safer now than it was however many years ago. On the scapegoating thing, Pierre, do you think it's inevitable that we'll go through a period where Bitcoiners are scapegoated?
So the ECB is certainly trying to gin that up. So they had written a paper basically saying that early adopters get rich at the expense of everyone else with Bitcoin. And then more recently, they said that Trump's embrace of Bitcoin is going to be the root of the next financial crisis, which I find hilarious because it's the ECB. So I definitely think that they want that to be the scapegoat. I think that we move further away from it being a scapegoat if with a strategic Bitcoin reserve, because basically it's saying we the people are the early adopters. And so we the people, you know, as a whole, are the beneficiaries of Bitcoin adoption. And so there's no scapegoating possible because everybody, it's for the benefit of everyone. And so then, you know, when the ECB says, oh, the United States is getting rich at the expense of everyone else, well, there's a rich tradition of that. And so if we look at the US dollar standard, it's been a story of the United States getting rich at the expense of the rest of the world. So I think that kind of falls flat. And it's also a moment of introspection of, well, you know, ECB was recently telling, I think the Czech central bank, telling them, oh, you know, don't put any Bitcoin in your reserves. So they have been denying themselves the opportunity to benefit from Bitcoin. And I think that gets back to that you know, name recognition.
Very salty.
Now. Yeah. Everybody has heard the word Bitcoin. Everybody has had the opportunity to listen to all of the episodes of What Bitcoin Did, to listen to all the noted episodes. We've been very transparent, open source, right? It's all out there. Mm-hmm. So I think that for somebody to say, it's not fair because I, you know, didn't buy. It's like, well, that's
your fault.
That's your responsibility. You know, it's never too late either. Mm-hmm. We're still very early. I heard somebody, Josh Mandel, make a very interesting point that, which we can get into that story, but he was pointing out that, you know, children are so innocent. Like, if we say that everybody buys Bitcoin at the price that they deserve, well, Bitcoin, you know, children deserve to buy it at $0 because they're innocent. So they don't like, and they weren't born, so they didn't have the opportunity to buy sooner. And so actually, that got me thinking that, so that's a really strong case for, you know, saving enough Bitcoin to have generational wealth so that you're passing it on to them.
I was going to say, that's the parents' prerogative then.
At $0. But also that as the state, that also introduces a responsibility that for all of the citizens that are not born yet, who don't have the opportunity to buy Bitcoin today, it's your responsibility to be stacking sats and selling gold. So
especially if you're going to, you know, take my money for Social Security Ponzi schemes,
yeah,
you might as well make something that actually works. Mm-hmm. Like if you're going to take my money, make, you know, put it to the best use.
Yeah.
And the best use is hoarding Bitcoin. Because, you know, something when people think about like taxes, sometimes they don't think about just how awful taxes are because they only think in terms of the government takes the money from you. And it's like, oh, you know, that's not cool. That's my money. Yeah, that's awful. But it of course gets worse because they tax you along the way on everything. Mm-hmm. But then they don't take that tax money and like do something useful with it. They use it to make your life worse. At least at, you know, at the very least, if you're going to take my money, you know, can I check a box somewhere on my IRS form that says put this into the reserve? You're like, I can't keep you from taking this money from you from me because you're going to put me in jail if I don't. But please put this here because I think, you know, that at least has a chance of increasing the social welfare.
But whereas who would build the roads,
whatever
Michael?
Else you're going to do is almost like definitionally going to decrease social welfare.
Yeah. One of the more interesting thing that's happening now is that like states are taking this prerogative and doing something themselves. I know you've been working quite closely with them in Texas. What's actually happening there? I don't fully know.
Yes. Yeah, so I think that the root of it is actually Elizabeth Warren, and that
she's come up a few times.
Yeah, she's come up a few times. So her activism against Bitcoin mining after China banned Bitcoin mining, lots of Bitcoin mining came here to the United States and especially here to Texas.
Yeah.
And so it got the attention of Elizabeth Warren and the environmentalist movement. And I'll put environmentalist in air quotes because lots of dubious things about that. And so they started trying to lobby to either ban Bitcoin mining. You know, the Biden administration said, oh, we're going to have a tax on Bitcoin mining that's essentially going to make it uneconomical here in the U.S. That didn't get passed. All thanks to the mining industry coming together and making, I think, two key arguments. One, with regards to the carbon emissions, the EPA already regulates or has a process for regulating carbon emissions at the source at which they come from, which is coal-fired power plants, natural gas plants, cars, obviously. Not nice. Bitcoin mining rigs, right? And so Bitcoin mining is already fully electrified. So this is obviously a politically motivated attack. The second was really about the value of Bitcoin. Because if Bitcoin has no value, then any expensive resources is a waste, mm-hmm. right? Just by definition. So we had to go and make the argument to a lot of different politicians, a lot of different policymakers and staff, hey, here's why Bitcoin has value. So even though, yes, Bitcoin mining does consume a lot of electricity, it's It's not a waste, because here's the value of why we're doing that. And so already we had planted seeds in these people's minds that Bitcoin has value. And so if it has value, well, maybe there'd be an interesting way for either I buy it for my personal account as a politician, or maybe the state should actually acquire some Bitcoin, because, you know, it's this sound money, freedom money that is aligned with my values. Then what happened was that Trump spoke at Nashville 2024, the big Bitcoin conference, and David Bailey and many others had orange-pilled Trump and a lot of people in his orbit. You know, for example, Lutnick, who was his campaign finance manager, was already orange-pilled. RFK was orange-pilled. So there was a lot of Bitcoin in the air, and then Trump came down and said, well, we're going to stockpile the Bitcoin that have been seized in the past. And then that was quickly followed up by Senator Lummis saying, hey, we're going to have a strategic Bitcoin reserve. And the interesting thing I think about politics is that politicians, especially Trump, he's a very influential person and he's a role model within the Republican Party. And so when he says that Bitcoin is worthwhile and is not, you know, something that we should be stockpiling, that doesn't just get the attention of voters. That also gets the attentions of all of the state Republicans. Mm-hmm. So I think that when it became a part of, let's say, the MAGA America First agenda of we need to be accumulating Bitcoin here in the United States, well, then Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, State Senator Charles Schwertner, they look at that and say, okay, we need to get moving on this and we need to start passing some of that legislation. They got some excellent advice from Lee Bratcher of the Texas Blockchain Council, who's been working very closely with them to steer this in, you know, a direction that's going to benefit the state and the people of Texas. So it seems like, assuming the state house does what it's supposed to do, which there's a lot of, you know, Texas politics, there's some acrimony between the House and the Senate, but putting that aside, that we'll have at least a symbolic amount of a strategic Bitcoin reserve here in Texas. And then that can grow over time, right? Everybody always starts small and then grows.
But weren't they talking about acquiring $500 million a year? And
so the initial draft of that bill had a limit of they can appropriate up to $500 million of the state budget per year to acquiring more Bitcoin. That limit was removed. Mm-hmm. So they could appropriate, for example, the full budget surplus, which is $23 billion. I don't think they'll do that. I think that they want to lower property taxes, another huge debate in Texas politics. So it might be more of a symbolic gesture at this point of, okay, we're just going to do like $21 million, you know, something like that to set the precedent and then see how things evolve over the next 2 years. The Texas legislature meets every 2 years. And so when that dollar value has grown a lot, then maybe they'll think, oh, you know, we have regret of not buying more. Let's FOMO in and let's really aggressively acquire Bitcoin.
Okay. And you think that's likely to pass?
I think the probability is at 75%. Yes.
That's very
cool. That it will pass. Yeah.
And how important do you think the states are in this movement?
I think they're very important. I think they're very important, first of all, because I live in one. and so I think that, you know, when we look at Texas does not have a central bank, right? So we are dependent on what's going on in DC with the Fed and what's going on in New York with the financial system. And Texas should be independent and that we should actually be masters of our own destiny. So we don't have the ability to just like print dollars and bail ourselves out. So I think that from that perspective, we already don't have monetary sovereignty. So it's not like, and just this was the case in El Salvador as well. Mm-hmm. They didn't have monetary sovereignty. They were dollarized. So there's that aspect of it. There's also the aspect of the Texas economy can be very cyclical because it's so dependent on oil and gas.
Yeah.
And so if the price of oil and gas goes very low, then that creates an economic downturn here in Texas. And so we want to be able to offset that by having an asset that's not correlated with those other external factors. And so that's why I think that it's really particularly important in Texas to have a reserve that is of Bitcoin.
Yes, just like mining is a load balancer on the Texas grid, Texas Bitcoin reserves would basically be able to be a load balancer on the economy, which is, I mean, that's what sound money is supposed to be. And, you know, there's also been other interesting moves in Texas. There's right now the development of the Texas Stock Exchange up in the Dallas area. So that's, you know, going to be moving a lot of economic activity into, you know, Texas away from New York. You can imagine a future where that becomes more, you know, Bitcoin denominated. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Texas not only ends up with its own electrical grid, but also has more control over its finances. And this is something, you know, I brought up the other day at the Bitcoin takeover. But, you know, the United States is built on federalism. And, you know, the United States is meant to be a collection of effectively sovereign states that come together for particular purposes where a united, you know, federal government allows for additional benefits for the states. But the states are not supposed to be just, you know, simply subservient to the federal government. But because of the financial system and being so dependent on the dollar, and specifically, you know, the you know, being, you know, printed away and you know, all of the business cycles and all of that, it makes it harder for states to actually exert their sovereignty. Mm-hmm. So there's constantly a carrot and stick with, you know, needing federal funds to be able to do various domestic, you know, in terms of the state, you know, state programs, whether it's, you know, education or roads or so on and so forth. You know, you were joking, who will build the roads? It's like, well, you know, we've put ourselves in a situation where that can get affected by the government. So, you know, classic example was the drinking age. I forget. I think this was the early 80s that they wanted to raise the drinking age to 21 across the country. And one of the ways that they were able to get states to give into that was by saying, if you don't, we will restrict highway funds, because you obviously, you know, mothers against drunk driving type stuff. And so a lot of states gave in. And in fact, I've never been to the border of Texas and Louisiana, and I don't know if it's gotten better over the years. But my understanding at Louisiana was a holdout, and it's like, no, we want to drink at 18. And what I've heard, you get to the border, it's like, you know, because the highway suddenly is a lot more bumpy. And so they rely on that. And, you know, the drinking age is one of those things that almost sounds superfluous. And like a lot of us are not, you know, sitting around like dreaming.
Pierre's from France. I think it's like 8 or something. In France. Yeah.
It's like you're born, they put it in the bottle for you a little, yeah, so you know, it seems like a frivolous example, but we can go on and look how like education has been distorted and forced under very federal level controls, which has all sorts of negative consequences because you're trying to come up with a curriculum for, you know, 350 million people, however many, you know, school children there are within that number, but like you're coming up with the curriculum for all those people, and it's like, I, you know, Pierre and I are best friends, and I doubt that we share all the same views of like, you know, what we want to be teaching children. So the idea of like the federal government trying to make those decisions as opposed to at the state level making more of those decisions and having more, you know, sort of federalism or subsidiarity or these sorts of things where it's like you should be solving the problems at the level where you should actually be solving them unless you need something, you know, higher. Having that kind of economic sovereignty, that financial sovereignty, I think with Bitcoin aligns these systems way better because at the individual level, you get to make these choices of what do I really value? And you don't have to go invest in the market. Maybe you're not going to make as much returns once Bitcoin levels off, in the long-term future. But you can still just be fine. You can decide that you want to operate a different way at the family level, at the company level, people with their balance sheets, and moving on to municipal, county, state level, all of these places, they all have to deal with the same balance sheet problems. Some of the, democratic governments, they're not necessarily dealing with it as purely productive people by nature of being a state, but they still have these financials that they have to deal with. And I believe that if they had more of a Bitcoin-based system, they would have to be more receptive to the incentives that we would prefer out of them imagine if the Texas Reserve, Bitcoin Reserve existed and it had tons of Bitcoin and it's and they're even able to put that Bitcoin to use into the future of putting it into some kind of different Bitcoin based financial things to kind of help, and they're able to get some level of purchasing power returns every single year. You have a natural surplus without taking a dime from anyone. Mm-hmm. And so when you turn around and you tell people, we need to raise your property taxes, suddenly the people have a much more, much easier way to say, not only am I not allowing you to raise my property taxes, I will not vote for that. But also you already have all the money you need. Take this, you need to decrease or get rid of the property taxes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think Bitcoin is heavily aligned with these sort of ideas, like I said, of federalism and subsidiarity and aligning the incentives and giving sort of each level more capacity to exert itself against, tyrannies that can form in the levels above them.
I love it. Hopefully it passes. I mean, more bullish on Texas than ever. I've got an interview coming up with a fellow European refugee, Chodem Easter, so I'm going to have to leave it there. But I thank you so much for both your time.
Yeah, thank you, Danny.
That's been great.